Our next session will start essentially immediately. We make this change. Let me introduce our next speakers. The title of the course is CMO, Chief Medical Officer, Friend or Foe. Our speaker will be Dr. Kenneth Welch. He received his Bachelor of Science in Pharmacy at the University of Mississippi, his medical degree at the University of Tennessee College of Medicine. He did a residency in obstetrics and gynecology at St. Joseph's Hospital and Medical Center in Phoenix. He has served as the Department of Defense contractor for the Tri-West Healthcare Alliance, in which he managed the TRICARE health benefit for active and retired military personnel and their beneficiaries in the 21 Western states. For 2 years, he worked with the Hospice of the Valley, the largest not-for-profit hospice organization in the United States. He also runs his own successful OBGYN private practice. He has done that both in Washington and in Arizona. Currently, he's a fellow of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and practices in Arizona. Welcome, Dr. Welch, and Dr. Hartman will watch over this group while I sort of do a sideways step, and he will close out the session. Okay, we've got that. Dr. Welch.
Well, I thought that was an amazing 2 hours to hear the perspective of the attorneys, but as a physician, like most of you, I get kind of nervous or anxious when there are a lot of attorneys around, and it's my habit to handle my anxiety with humor. So I think Mr. Dahlquist sort of allowed this to happen, but I'll tell you about my son, who's a research physiologist, and he recently told me that they're going to start using lawyers instead of lab rats for experiments. And there are three reasons for that. One, there are more lawyers than there are lab rats. Two, the research technicians kind of get attached to the lab rats. And three, there's some things you just can't get a lab rat to do. So anyway, he allowed me by telling the first lawyer joke. The reason I'm here is that I've known Al Hartman for almost 40 years. He's a good friend, and we talk frequently. And as you know from the circular to announce this meeting, one of the focuses Al wanted to take was the fact that he had gone through a rather difficult situation. He was accused of a felony, and this is, as you heard, very serious. Fortunately, it turned out well. Well, when Al first told me, I know Al, I knew that he would never do anything of the felony nature. Well, there was one time he stole a car, but it was his car, and it was a long story. He parked in a school parking lot at night where it said school bus only. His car was towed, and he basically stole it back. But that's, like I said, that's the only time I know where he committed a felony willingly. During the course of all the discussion of what Al was going through, one of the questions he asked me was the CMO thing. What is a CMO? Who would be a CMO? You know, what is the reason for that? So he said, do you know anyone that would come and tell us what a CMO does, what you have to be a CMO, and what a CMO does on a regular basis? So, of course, I thought of myself, and was honored by the invitation until I saw the name of the meeting, Pitfalls of Medical Practice, and then I realized that I guess I'm one of those pitfalls. So what I did is try to put together a discussion of what a CMO is, what a CMO does. A lot of it's going to sort of follow along what was just presented. As is the case in most medical presentations, I would like to point out I have no financial disclosures to make. That's why I'm still out on the road. Now, what is a chief medical officer? It's part of the leadership team in either a hospital or a clinic It's a member of the C-suite, and that's a term for the group of leaders that are involved in this particular enterprise. There's a chief executive officer who is sort of the big honcho. There's the chief medical officer, and I'll define what that's supposed to do. Chief nursing officer, chief operational officer who does all of the running of the hospital as far as dietary, various things like that, and the chief financial officer who tells you if you're going to be able to keep your doors open next year or not. One of the interesting things about being a CMO, though, even though you are a member of this team, you're looked upon as different because you're not really an executive. You're a physician. And when you go to the medical staff, they look at you as not really a physician. You're part of the executive team. So the real challenge is to try to understand that what you are is an interface between the two to help each understand the other. And that can be challenging depending on the various circumstances. Evolution of the CMO position. When I finished residency in 1981 and went to work at a hospital in Kirkland, Washington, there was no CMO. Basically, the chief of medical staff interfaced with the administrator, and any problems that occurred ended up with a decision of those folks and the medical executive committee. Well, as we got through the 80s and into the 90s, if you remember, that's about the time where Burlington Northern and a number of other employees who were having their health care expenses go quite high said, we got to do something about this. So HMOs came out. HMOs, hospital physician organizations, PPOs, basically the purchasers of healthcare began to say, okay, it's no more cost plus. You can't just continue to add services, add procedures, and just say, okay, I'm going to charge this for it, shift costs for the people who didn't pay to the people who did pay. Things changed, and as a result, the hospital began to have to look at their costs and what they were doing. And the physicians began to have to look at how they were going to stay in practice with the new change, where the pie was more finite than it had been before, and the decision of what portion of that pie am I going to get became a point of contention. The other thing that was pointed out by a couple of the attorneys is we really began to see the regulation of medical practice increase, and it has continued to increase from that time. And part of that was Medicare. If you remember in the early 90s or early 80s even, DRGs. The DRG basically said, okay, if you have a patient that has pneumonia, we're going to give you this amount of money. Whether you have a pneumonia that's taken care of in 2 days and you can send the patient home, or whether you have a patient with pneumonia who's in the hospital 14 days. Again, the money's finite. And that's true for both the hospital and the physician. That began to put pressure on the relationship. So the decision that many of the organizations made is we need someone to act as an interface. And we need to have someone that is employed by the hospital but has the medical knowledge to be able to help us determine when this is truly something that we should do, or when we should say, no, we can't just continue to add things on. The American College of Physician Executives, which has within the last couple of years become the American Association of Physician Leaders, had been around since the 70s. They represented particularly the medical directors of health plans, physicians that were involved in various other non-clinical activities but were in an executive occupation within their profession. They began to see this as something that really needed to be done, and they wanted to support it by helping educate these physicians who were going to leave the clinical aspect and become part of the executive team, so that one, they could understand what the executives were talking about, but also not give up their ability to look at the big picture as physicians. So they have developed a very good and very significant amount of education in all these areas that help physicians who go into the physician executive branch of medical care have the background they need. Now, there are certain characteristics. Let me give you the official job description that I think to some extent most organizations use of what a chief medical officer really is. And this was the job description of the chief medical officer position that I had for several years. The chief medical officer is the senior clinical officer responsible for the quality and safety of patient care. It's about as basic as it gets. And that's why I chose to do it. You know, why would I want to go to the dark side? This was a way when I could no longer be in clinical practice, I could still feel like I had an impact on patient care. And that is the fundamental role of the chief medical officer. Now, the qualities you need are clinical credibility. One of the things that the American Academy of Physician Leadership deals with is there are a lot of people coming out of residency who've decided they don't like people that much and they don't want to take care of patients. They want to get into a leadership role. And the American Academy of Physician Leaders says, you got to go out and practice for a while, because if you're going to talk to a physician who's been doing practice for 20 years and you have no idea what he's been going through on a daily basis or she's been going through on a daily basis, you're not going to have any credibility. You've got to be honest. You've got to, if the administrators are screwing up, you've got to be willing to say they're screwing up. And you've got to help them understand why this is not going to fly with patient care, quality, or safety. You have to also be able to tell physicians sometimes, hey, this is not right. This is not going to improve patient care. Let's figure this out. You've got to have vision. And what that means is you've got to see the big picture. One of the problems with medical staff structure, and I've been members of the medical executive committee a number of times during my practice, and it's almost impossible not to bring your biases. If there are turf wars between the perinatal doctors who want to do the OB ultrasound versus the radiologists who want to do all the ultrasound, they're looking out for protecting their turf. You have to be able to look at the big picture and decide, is there a way that we can mediate this and do the appropriate thing based on what's best for patient care? And I'll tell you, because I'm an OB, in my mind, the perinatologist should be doing it because they have much more specific experience in this part of imaging than the radiologists do. There are a number of radiologists who are more than happy for that to happen because they don't want the liability of missing a deformity or judging a baby not to be growing at the right rate. So I think if you look at how can we come to a consensus that makes sense and always answers the question, is this the better thing for patient care? If you can ask that question and answer it yes, it's going to be hard for anybody to argue. You have to have the vision of the big picture from the standpoint that, yes, sometimes the hospital and the executive committee are going to have to say no to something. And the reason for that is they understand the bigger picture of the finances. They understand the fact that we just don't have the money to start this service line or to add this next level CT or MRI that the various folks are wanting, because one, it is better, but is it really going to improve patient care enough to justify putting ourselves on a very risky financial basis? So you have to have the vision to look at the big picture, try to understand that we as physicians want a place that we can take our patients and know they're going to get taken care of well, and that we're going to be comfortable bringing our family to this hospital or to this clinic. And if we can't say that, we need to work hard to figure out how we can. One of the other things is you have to have excellent communication skills, and that's obvious, but there are times when, as a chief medical officer, you have to have crucial conversations. You have to sit down with someone you practice beside for 20 years and tell them something that they're not going to want to hear. And a lot of people don't like confrontation. A lot of people don't like conflict. I certainly don't. But I realized early on in the instruction that I achieved at the American College of Physician Executive Training is you have to do that sometimes, and you have to learn how to do it. You have to learn how to do it in a very effective, appropriate, and certainly in a very human way. You have to understand, if you're telling somebody something they don't want to hear, you have to let them know that what you're trying to do is keep them from getting into some of the things that you heard the attorneys talk about. There is advanced education. I mean, you know, as Al Hartman always talks about, what did you learn at CMO school? Well, there are certainly places you can go and learn. There are a number of MBA programs directed toward healthcare. There's the Master's in Medical Management. And then the one that I chose was through the American College of Physician Executives, and that's the designation of a certified physician executive. It required 138 hours of extra learning to achieve that, to go through a tutorial and an examination, and then if you met all the criteria, you would have that that designation. And it really does prepare you for a lot of those things. It gives you techniques, it gives you strategies, it also gives you a resource, because there are a lot of times you're going to run into a situation that you've never heard of before. You have a resource and other colleagues that you can use social media to say, what would you do in this situation? And that's very helpful when you're that lone ranger out there and you don't know exactly which way you need to go. You think you do, but you're not sure, to have somebody to bounce that off of. Now, if my next slide is the correct one, we get to what does a chief medical officer do every day? Well, what does he do? Meetings, meetings, meetings. And if you read the caption, it says, oh him, he's board certified. You get bored at all the meetings, but they're requirements. You have to go to the various department meetings. You have to go to compliance meetings, all sorts of things. The main task for a CMO is to know what is happening in all areas of the hospital organization. Now, we heard Mr. Dahlquist talk about credentialing and that sort of thing. What I'd like to make as my primary point about a CMO is we have the desire to make sure that healthcare provided, patient care provided at our organization is appropriate and safe, and it's of high quality. If it gets to the medical executive committee or it gets to the board, many times that's too late. What a chief medical officer does is, on a daily basis, has an idea of what's going on in the facility or the clinic or wherever he's the chief medical officer, so that hopefully he can see things beginning to trend that could lead to suspension of privileges, could lead to legal action, could lead to the $50,000 HIPAA non-compliance fine that's out there. So how do you do that? Well, the biggest statement of fact that the American College of Physician Executives said about a CMO is you cannot be a CMO sitting behind a computer monitor screen. You got to be out knowing what's going on in your hospital, because visibility leads to credibility. If they know who you are and know that you're someone who's really trying to do the right thing, trying to help all of them work better in a better environment so they can provide the care they need, if they see you, you begin to build credibility. And once you build credibility and they see you go through a few things and understand you do have some clinical credibility, you do have integrity, you do have the ability to listen, that's one of the biggest things. You learn so much more by listening. You're going to begin to be more effective than you would be if you sit in your office waiting for problems to arise and then you call the doctor and say, come to my office. That's the principal. That's not the chief medical officer. How do you know what's going on? Well, you got to get out there and be around. You got to be visible and you got to know your medical staff. You have to know who practices there. You have to know who's good. You have to know who may be on the edge. You have to know who's having problems, who's fighting with whom. You have to know those turf battles. You have to know which medical group wants to be the hospitalist and which medical group is the hospitalist group and is the one that wants to be beginning to put out little digs at the other folks, creating some problems in that regard, and you have to head that off. You need to know your nursing staff, because the nurses, as we all know, see all the warts that the physicians have, and they know, if anybody does, who's practicing in a way that could lead to problems. Now, keep in mind, that's a two-way street. In my experience, I've had a couple of instances where there were nurses who had agendas and began to write up a physician on repeated basis because they felt the physician had disrespected them or inadvertently said something that upset them. So keep in mind, when a CMO gets a particular complaint or instance brought up, the first thing you do is you have to know that there's two sides to every story. So you have to get the information you need to understand, is this legit or is this someone with an agenda? Is this something that's been recurrent? You know, the bottom line is, in my opinion, a CMO has to have every incident report come through his desk. Many of them are trite. Many of them aren't that significant. But if you have a physician who begins to get 2, 3, 4 incident reports a week, that's a trend. And you know this is something different, something new. Something's going on with this guy or this gal. This is not the norm. So that's when you have to go out and sit down and talk to them and really begin to, okay, we've lost the slides. Do we have, let's see if I can, okay, well, we'll see if we can get the slides back. That's too bad because I didn't memorize the speech. I was going off the slides, so I may have to launch into a song and dance before we're done here, which would be terrible. But I think that one of the things that came about was that the attorneys talked about a lot of things that I faced on a daily basis. Let me give you some examples. Disruptive behavior. Now, we all know basically what disruptive behavior is. It's the physician who yells at nurses, who throws the gloves, you know, when they come out of a room and says, I never had such incompetent people in my life. Now, we all feel that. And, you know, you want to get that out so it doesn't cause your blood pressure to go up. But look at it the other way. You have a right to have a safe, comfortable, supportive work environment. So does the nurse, so does the lab tech, so does the radiology tech, so does the dietitian, and so does the housekeeper. If you're thinking you're back in a 1960s Ben Casey TV show and you can behave like that, you're creating what's known as a hostile work environment. Now, one, that's actionable, as one of the attorneys pointed, but how does that relate to patient care? Well, here's how that relates if you don't already know this. If I'm a surgeon and I yell at the nurses and at 9 o'clock at night my patient is beginning to run a fever and looking a little less well than the other patients and the nurse says, well, I really should call Dr. Welch, but God, he's just going to yell at me. I think I'll just wait a little longer and see what's going to happen. And then about midnight, patients really begin to look bad and the nurse says, I really ought to call, but you know, he's so mean when I call him at midnight. And talks to the supervising nurse, what do you think? Oh, I know, I hate to talk to that guy when something's wrong. Let's just give a little more fluids and see what happens. If you're the surgeon, you needed to know at 9 o'clock what's going on. If you create an environment where they don't want to take the time to give you a call and tell you how your patient's doing, because if it turns out the patient's okay, you're going to rip them a new one and make them feel worthless, then that's going to impact your patient's care. And one of the examples that sticks with me is we had a surgeon at the hospital where I was a CMO who was a great surgeon. She was well-trained. She was very good. You know, had this air about her that everybody liked her. Except the thing you heard from the nurses is I would go to her for my surgery, but I don't want to take care of her patients. And I thought, what's that all about? She didn't yell. She was, you know, she was sort of this person you really wanted to be like. But what she did is she belittled. So it does not require yelling. It requires belittling, or it requires some behavior that makes the person you're interacting with feel less valued and less important than they need to be. And that's probably, you know, if a surgeon is a jerk and he's yelling, most of the nurses say, oh, what a jerk. But if there's somebody that they recognize as a very good surgeon and someone they want to be like, and that person is belittling him, it's sort of like your mother saying, you're such a jerk, you know, you never finish your meal and that sort of thing. There's many ways to make the people you work with feel less valued. And it's very important to understand they are valued if they're taking care of the patients you're responsible for. If they don't feel like a part of a team, if they don't feel like they're in an environment where they can put their input in and have it be valued rather than dismissed or diminished, you've got a situation where the quality and the safety of patient care is not what it should be. So keep in mind that, yeah, you know, sometimes we have to blow off steam, but it's a different place now than it was years ago when everybody said, oh, that's just the way doctors are. That's not the way doctors can be anymore. And it's not because you have to play nice in the sandbox. It's because it truly does affect patient care. Now, one of the other areas that they talked about up here was inappropriate behavior, not necessarily disruptive, but inappropriate behavior. And I think we all know if a doctor's going around grabbing the rear end of any female employee, that's very inappropriate. But there are other things that can create a real problem also. I had a couple of different situations I had to deal with as chief medical officer. And one that I recall particularly was we had a hospitalist who worked at night. It so happened his wife was a nurse in the emergency department, and she worked nights. You'd think, this guy's going to behave himself. Well, there was a young nurse who was very good that he all of a sudden took a liking to, and he thought, you know, he was being supportive of her and encouraging her. But every time he saw her, he said, oh, you're such a good nurse. I love you. And he'd come over and hug her and just, you know, thinking he was giving her a boost and making her feel better about herself. She got to the point where she would actively try to avoid him, and she would get panic attacks. And it was very difficult because he said, my wife's there. I'm not going to do anything. But she got so bad that she went to the chief nursing officer and said, I'm going to have to leave. I can't work with this guy. So what's going on here? Well, when the chief nursing officer said, Dr. Welch, you have to deal with this, I tried to get both sides of the story. So I asked if I could talk to the nurse. Turns out she had been abused as a young lady by an uncle who started out by putting his arm around her and giving her a hug and telling her how great she was and how pretty she was. And it went on from there. So even though he had the best of intentions, he was violating her space. He was not taking into account that how he meant it and how she took it might be two very different things. And being an OBGYN, I'm sure all of us who see women on a regular basis, it's absolutely astounding to me how many women have been abused as youngsters. And their frame of reference in how someone in a position of authority who comes and wants to hug them or wants to tell them how great they are, to them, that brings back memories that are very difficult. We had another physician who was of the same type, a very nice guy, and he was very affectionate, but he didn't know about boundaries. And we had a young woman from one of the offices come into the cafeteria, and he walked up with, this was in Arizona, so it's very hot, he walked up with a bottle of water that had come from the refrigerator, and he just put it on her arm and says, boy, that ought to cool it down, shouldn't it? And she didn't know who this guy was or what was going on, but he had invaded her space. She had a very similar story to the first one. So I had to counsel him and say, you can't do that. Now, a third story I'll tell you about was similar to one that was mentioned about anesthesia. We had a young OBGYN female who had been within a year of leaving her residency. Very good, very, you know, going to do everything right. She had a patient that she brought to the emergency, to the operating room for a D&C. The patient was a very attractive young woman. She had had breast augmentation. And the anesthesiologist, who was in his 50s, was, you know, had always been a straight shooting guy. When they were draping, he says, wow, look at that. Look at those breasts. Whoever did that did a great job. And he touched them. He said, they're very soft. Look at that. You know, thinking he was admiring a surgical outcome. Well, I got a call from the female OBGYN saying, you know, this is assault. He should be, you know, I'm going to call the cops. I said, well, wait, you know, let's just see what's going on. She finally calmed down. She said, I just never want him on any of my cases again. One of the things the CMO has to do is be the person who communicates to the patients when something happens. So I had to go tell this young woman while she was in the recovery room what had happened. I said, you know, he lifted your drape, said, wow, you had a great job, they're soft and all of that, so, you know, this is inappropriate. Do you wish to take it any further? She said, no, that's great. I thought they were great, too. I let anybody look at them if they wants to, so she was very comfortable with it. You know, I didn't ask to see them. That would have been inappropriate. But she was very proud of them. You know, this was one of the things that she had done to make herself feel better, and she didn't have any embarrassment or anything like that. Nonetheless, we put him on a six-month suspension from our operating room. Now, he was part of a large group that provided our anesthetic coverage. He continued to be able to go to others because we counseled him. He realized when we sat down and said, you know, you understand that's inappropriate. He says, oh, yeah, I can see that. He came forward and said, yeah, I did something wrong. I'm really embarrassed by that. So we put him on a six-month suspension from practicing in our operating room, but not suspending his privileges necessarily, just within his group. They agreed to not send him back there. And then when he came back, he had a six-month probation where he had to have someone in the room certify that he had behaved appropriately. Because of the way we structured it, we didn't have to report it. And I can assure you, he has been a stellar practitioner since that time. But this could have been an absolute landmine. With him not thinking, he was thinking surgical results, this is, you know, impressive, but to other people in the room, it was totally inappropriate. We had another patient, another physician, who was in his 50s, pulmonologist. His wife was a nurse in the ICU. He had, when I got there, had two situations where he had been counseled, and his problem, he would sit in the nursing station and talk to nurses who bantered with him sexually and explicitly. Now, you think, well, that's consenting adults. Well, unfortunately, in the nursing station, other people were around who don't want to hear that, find that repulsive. That's like telling sexist or lawyer jokes or something like that when people don't want to hear those. Counseled him, said, this is what you're doing wrong. You've got to stop this. He said, oh, yeah, okay. I understand that maybe people who overhear us are offended by it and that sort of thing. Third time came up, he did the same thing again. He even said this time, well, one of the nurses is sexting me with pictures of her in various states of undress, so it's not just me. I said, whoa, whoa, you know, you've signed two agreements that you won't do this any longer. And so we had him sign a third. Fourth time he did it, we suspended him from the hospital because you just can't have that going on in a nursing station where everyone else is listening, because if you want to look at it from a patient care standpoint, nurses are getting harder and harder to find. They have choices of where they want to practice. And if they have to practice in a facility where people can sit there and talk about their sexual proclivities and wearing a miniskirt to a party without underwear so I can put my hand under your skirt, this was the kind of thing he was doing, there are people who don't want to hear that. In fact, probably many people here today don't want to hear that. But it's something that you do have to deal with when the time comes. The other thing that was brought up here is the compliance issues. You know, there is no question that there is an increasing number of regulations and rules placed on hospitals and physicians. It's hard to keep up with them. And it's even harder to change behavior that you've been doing for 20 years that seems to be working well, but now maybe isn't within the rules and regulations. So in my mind, what a CMO has to do is, one, have a pretty reasonable working knowledge of what the changes in the rules and regulations are. He has to be aware and be able to find out any situation where maybe behavior is over the edge. One of the biggest ones is HIPAA violations. There are people that one in particular I think of was a physician whose husband was a minister, and one of the congregation came in and was having a procedure done, and she and her husband were talking about it, and she said, well, I'll just go by and look at her chart. Okay, well, you can't do that. If you're not listed as either the attending physician or a consulting physician, you cannot do that unless the patient is asked, can this doctor access your chart and then discuss it with you? If that's the case, it needs to be documented in the chart that that's the case, and then this physician who was a friend and whose husband was the minister where this patient went, that's okay. But if that doesn't happen, quite frankly, that's a HIPAA violation. So we had to instruct this physician that, you know, you can't do that unless you have this. And she said, well, I've been doing this for years. And we said, I know, but that's now a $50,000 fine for the hospital and potentially a $50,000 fine for you. We're not going to talk about whether it's right or wrong that you can't look at a friend's chart and give an opinion. The point is, you have to follow what the regulations are and have the patient say it's okay. Now, on the other hand, if I'm in the hospital and one of my colleagues who I'm not real friendly with wants to find out if I'm being treated with VD or something like that, I don't want him looking at my chart unless I have given him permission to. So you can look at it from the patient's standpoint. These are the kind of things as a CMO you have to face on a regular basis. The bottom line is I look at it particularly like Mr. Dahlquist, who was into credentialing and that sort of thing. My job is to provide the best care, best situation for the patients, the nurses, and all of the ancillary folks to take care of the patients as they can. Am I there to be a foe to the physicians? No, I'm not. I'm there to hopefully have had the opportunity, because I don't have to see 40 patients in a day, to learn what the changes in regulations are, to learn what the risk of medical practice are, to have the visibility and the time to go out and look and try to help them see things coming down the road that they may not know or even risk, and to give them the best I can as far as what my interpretation of the situation is, what I can do to help them. And it certainly is a two-way street. If a physician comes to me and says, the nurse in ICU has an attitude to her and she is just really not following my orders, she's becoming passive aggressive, she's, you know, doing this sort of thing, I'm going to listen to that. I'm going to say to that physician, let me find out, because there's two sides to every story. And if you have anyone impairing your ability to take care of your patients, that's as important to me as someone else saying you're impairing their ability to take care of your patients. The bottom line, everything I do, everything I did every day, was to say, would this place that I'm working in be the kind of hospital I'd want to bring my family members, because I know they're going to be working as hard as they can to have the best safety and quality of patient care out there. At that point, I'll stop. I was told I was supposed to allow a few minutes for questions. So if there are any, I will entertain them. If not, we'll get out 10 minutes early. Are there any questions? Okay, let me ask you a question. Based on what I've said, do you think a CMO is a friend or a foe? I hope so. I hope that's it. And, you know, every CMO is different. I will say that, just like every physician is different.
Okay. Thanks, Ken. Thanks, everybody. I've enjoyed today. I'll tell you, you know, it's scary and difficult, but one thing about having it nearly taken away from you is you realize what you value, and we can do it. We can handle these regulations and these risks because it's worth it. So let's see. It's tomorrow at 7 we start. Tonight's the Dinosaur Park. Tomorrow night you need to get reservations if you want to come to the dinner and Shakespeare thing here. Good night. Anything else? Yeah, Hogwarts is Friday. There you go.